Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Trump budget that has both conservative and liberal economists scratching their heads in disbelief at the amateurism and mathematical absurdity of what the White House director of the OMB, former Congressman Mulvaney, presented. Jacob Liebenluft, a senior advisor at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, who previously worked at the National Economic Council at the White House, joins us to discuss the double counting of $2 trillion in additional revenues, which are in themselves dubious and wishful thinking based on the ideological pipe dream that cutting taxes on the wealthy and corporations will magically spur economic growth to make up for the loss in tax revenues for the Treasury. We'll also analyze the extent to which the entire budget punishes the poor in order to further reward the already rich and address it in terms of the guns versus butter paradigm as more guns are foisted on the pork-bloated Pentagon while butter is rationed to those who can prove they are looking for work. Then we'll look into yesterday's testimony by the former CIA director, John Brennan, in which he recounted how he had warned his counterpart, Alexander Bortnikov, the head of Russia's FSB, that, quote, American voters would be outraged by any Russian attempt to interfere in the election. Mark Lowenthal, the president of the Intelligence and Security Academy, who served as assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production and vice chairman for evaluation at the National Intelligence Council, joins us to discuss what happened to bipartisanship when it comes to a foreign adversary attacking the very foundation of American democracy itself. Then finally, we will assess President Trump's visit with Pope Francis in the Vatican, at which his daughter and wife were in attendance, and where, at the end, the Pope expressed concern to Melania Trump about her husband's eating habits and expansive girth. Tiziana Deering, a professor of social work at Boston College and the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston, joins us to discuss the extent to which the Pope was able to influence Trump to change his views and policies on climate change and immigration. And joining us now is Jacob Liebenluft, who is a senior advisor at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, who previously worked at the National Economic Council at the White House, and most recently as a deputy assistant to the President for Economic Policy and deputy director of the National Economic Council. He also served as the economic policy director on President Obama's 2012 campaign and began his work in the Obama administration at the Department of the Treasury, where he worked from 2009 to 2010 during the height of the financial crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Liebenluft.
Thank you so much for having me.
And what do you make of this budget that's already got people scratching their heads, both on the left and the right? Economists are basically looking at this with dismay at its sort of amateurism and its mathematical absurdity, where they're double billing, if in effect, counting twice at $2 trillion in mythical revenues that they predict that the tax cuts will generate. And so where does sort of ideology end and reality begin here?
Well, I think that's a great question to ask when you're looking at a budget like the one the administration put out. I think I look at two basic fundamental problems with this budget. I think the first is the issue you pointed to, that it simply doesn't add up, that there are assumptions about growth that are wildly out of line with what outside forecasters suggest and what the policies that they're proposing would produce, according to independent economists, that they include a set of gimmicks, first and foremost, the double counting of the impact of growth from their tax cuts that you mentioned. But also, I think more broadly, it's important to look at this budget and recognize what it says about the priorities of this administration. What you see here is deep cuts in basic programs that support health and nutrition, that invest in future growth and innovation, and at the same time, principles for large tax cuts for the nation's wealthiest people and largest corporations. So I think there's, in a way, two fundamental flaws. There's a basic mathematical flaw in how it adds up, but also I think there's a broader flaw in what this says about this administration's priorities for the nation.
Well, in that regard, given that they're slashing the State Department, the EPA, and just about every other government department in order to pay for an extra $54 billion for defense, which is already at an incredibly high level, greater than it was during the Cold War, that's one priority that you can certainly question. But the other one is that they're cutting funds or eviscerating an already tattered and insufficient safety net in order to punish the poor to reward the already rich.
That's exactly right. We obviously have been debating for several months now, and there's new information today about around the healthcare bill that's under consideration in Congress. And in many ways, this budget is an extension of what that bill does. What we see in that bill is deep cuts to healthcare, which would, according to CBO, cost 23 million people coverage in order to pay for tax cuts for the wealthy and corporations. This budget goes beyond that. It adds, for example, another $600 billion of cuts to the Medicaid program that covers low-income families, people with disabilities, seniors in nursing homes. It cuts programs like nutrition assistance, and it proposes even deeper tax cuts. So you're exactly right. I think many of us believe that we need to take steps to strengthen the safety net as well as invest in our future. This would go backwards in a historic way, and it would do so to provide tax breaks for people who are already doing quite well.
So the question then is, are they going to succeed? I mean, for example, we know that there's chaos and incompetence at the White House, and they're consumed by the Russian investigation and by their own incompetence and by the erratic behavior of the president. But it looks as though the Republicans have their heads down. Ryan and McConnell are getting what they want. Not that they're getting much help from the White House, but they're enacting their agenda. And the horrible evisceration of Obamacare that came out of the House is now in the Senate. And my understanding is that the Senate are going to try and come up, or the Republicans in the Senate are going to try and come up with something and try and sell it and have Trump sign it. So where do we stand vis-a-vis these outrageous priorities that they presented in this budget and the possibility that some of this could actually be enacted?
Well, there's a tendency often to view a budget, and this one in particular, as, you know, quote, dead on arrival. And you see members of Congress say, we would never pass this particular budget or pass it in whole cloth. But you're exactly right that when you get to the fundamental elements of this budget, they end up actually being quite consistent with the priorities of congressional Republicans, starting first and foremost with health care. We see that, again, these deep cuts to health in the bill that is still proceeding in the Senate in order to pay for tax cuts for the wealthy. And then, of course, even in these other cuts to other programs, like SNAP, the Nutrition Assistance Program, we see indications that Congress may want to pursue those as well as part of their effort to pursue a large tax cut going forward. So I think there's the amateurishness with which this budget was presented that you mentioned at the beginning of this discussion, I think masks the degree to which the fundamental ideas in this budget are actually quite consistent with those of congressional Republicans and indeed have a reasonable chance of making it into law in some form or another, even if not in their totality.
And again, I'm speaking with Jacob Liebenlof, who's a senior advisor at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, who previously worked at the National Economic Council at the White House, and most recently as a deputy assistant to the President for Economic Policy and deputy director of the National Economic Council. He also served as the economic policy director on President Obama's 2012 campaign and began his work in the Obama administration at the Department of Treasury, where he worked in 2009 and 2010 during the height of the financial crisis. And to that extent, going back to your work during the financial crisis, George W. Bush handed Obama a complete catastrophe, and Obama was hamstrung from the beginning, and it took a long while to get the economy back, and the Republicans gave him absolutely no help all along the way. The situation could not be more different for Donald Trump, who's handed a recovering economy, and all he does is complain about how terrible Obama was. So does anybody, you know, just when you want to start with the actual landscape of reality that we're dealing with, does anybody believe, I mean, has he been successful in getting his supporters to believe that things are as bad as they are? I remember all that stuff about carnage and...
Sure.
Is that resonating? Or, I mean, it strikes me that he's actually incredibly lucky compared to his predecessor, who he's done nothing but demonize.
Well, certainly the rhetoric we heard both on the campaign and in the first few months of the administration does not suggest that. I think you hear a pretty misleading picture of the economy that President Trump inherited, one where the unemployment rate, of course, has been brought down by half compared to where it started under President Obama and where wage growth has picked up again. Having said that, I think, you know, those of us who are in the Obama administration and who are offering an alternative to President Trump are under no illusions that the economy is perfect. We still need to do quite a bit more to strengthen wage growth and job growth, particularly among lower and moderate income people. We need to address income inequality. I think the troubling thing is that everything we've seen from President Trump as well as from congressional Republicans would move us in the wrong direction. And so I think it's a problem of both a diagnosis of where we are today, but even worse, I think, a problem with the prescription that's being offered.
But we've had several decades now of trickle-down economics, starting with, or you can go back to Reagan, but let's just start with George W. Bush. He gave massive tax cuts to the rich. And what's been happening over the last few decades is the rich have been getting richer and richer and the poor are getting poorer and poorer. And those just are the facts. We've heard a lot of talk about income inequality, but nothing appears to be being done to reverse that. And Donald Trump is absolutely adding to this, exacerbating this with a fire hose of indifference to the poor. I mean, this everything that he's doing in giving all this extra money to the Pentagon at the expense of everything else, and then on top of that, basically giving even more exorbitant tax cuts to the super, super already wealthy at the expense of the poor. And this tattered safety net, inadequate as it is being eviscerated. So I find what's happening now just so much more shocking in the context of what has been going on now for decades.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, if you think just about the health care bill, and again, I think the health care bill is in many ways one piece that represents the broader whole of the Trump and Republican agenda, I'm not sure there's an example in modern American history of any single policy that would do more to redistribute from low and moderate income people to the wealthy. And as you point out, that's exactly the wrong direction from where we need to go. And yet we see policies that cut health coverage, that cut the social safety net, and what we get in return is tax breaks that go overwhelmingly, if not exclusively, to the very, very top and large corporations. And so I think what's so troubling is obviously we have not done enough, as you say, over the course of decades to address inequality. I think we took some steps over the course of the Obama administration, raising taxes among the wealthiest households, efforts like the Affordable Care Act, but we clearly need to do more, and everything that we're seeing from President Trump and from Republicans in Congress would go in the opposite direction.
But what's different from the normal trickle-down mantra, in effect, Donald Trump is doing a bait and switch, because he ran as a Democrat. He ran to protect Social Security. He ran to protect Medicare and Medicaid, which he's already cutting. And this is the part of it that's extraordinary. I mean, remember the mantra was drain the swamp. He's got more lobbyists and corporate lawyers in there than any other administration. And the ethics people are trying to demand some transparency there, and there's none whatsoever. This is an extraordinary bait and switch. So the question I would have is, at what point do the American people, particularly his own supporters, wake up and recognize how they're being hosed?
Well, I think, you know, that begins to happen as the implications of what President Trump is trying to do become more clear. And we've seen some of that already as President Trump has offered, has supported the House health care bill, as he has proposed policies and taken steps that really violate the promises he made on his campaign. I think that has had an issue, has had an impact on his popularity if we look at polling. I mean, this is a historically unpopular health care bill, and it certainly seems to have contributed to his approval ratings. But I think, unfortunately, we are in a position where it has taken to get to this point where some of these policies are a very real possibility for there to be a full appreciation to how diametrically opposed Donald Trump's agenda is from his rhetoric on the campaign.
But there's some question as to whether or not Donald Trump's chaotic presidency and all the focus on Russia and all of the daily explosions and tweets, etc., is somehow enabling the Ayn Randian House Speaker Ryan and the incredibly corrupt Majority Leader McConnell to push through their agenda. For example, the affordable repeal and replace of Obamacare that you were just talking about. As horrible as that bill was that came out of the House, they are actually quietly working on it in the Senate. So, at what point do you think they will be able to just sort of slip something by, because we're all so distracted about what's going on with this presidency?
Well, I think that's a real concern. The one thing that heartens me is that we've seen quite a bit of public outcry when the House health bill started moving forward and ultimately passed. And we're seeing quite a bit of pressure in the Senate at the grassroots level that I think is demonstrating to Republicans who might be considering a vote for this damaging repeal bill about what the political implications might be for them. I think one of the challenges of major pieces of policy like the health care bill currently under consideration is that it is often not easy for people to fully understand the implications it might have for their lives. But we're seeing that happen, and I think as that happens, hopefully we're seeing political pressure that may scare legislators from taking these most damaging actions.
Well, you know, they keep saying it's the budget's dead on arrival. Lindsey Graham said that, but I don't believe them. I think at some point or other they're going to come up with something, and it may not be as hideous as this first go around, but it's still going to be hideous. So I think we got to keep our eye on this, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think these damaging policies can be stopped if the political pressure is put on those who might vote for them, but we should be quite afraid that this healthcare bill and then some of the most frightening cuts in the budget could really become a reality. And so, my overall take would be this budget is not going to happen as a whole. This healthcare bill in the House may change, but there is a high risk for policies that could hurt millions of people from being implemented, and the only thing that can stop that is if congressmen and senators believe that their jobs are on the line if they vote for these damaging cuts.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Jacob Liebenluft.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jacob Liebenluft, who's a senior advisor at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, who previously worked at the National Economic Council at the White House, and most recently as Deputy Assistant to the President for Economic Policy and Deputy Director of the National Economic Council. He also served as the Economic Policy Director on President Obama's 2012 campaign and began his work in the Obama administration at the Department of Treasury, where he worked in 2009 and 2010 during the height of the financial crisis. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into yesterday's testimony by the former CIA director John Brennan.
Nobody knows what to do. You know what we need, though?
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mark Lowenthal. He's the president of the Intelligence and Security Academy, a professor at the Johns Hopkins University. He served as assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, vice chairman for Evaluation, National Intelligence Council, deputy assistant secretary of State for Intelligence, and staff director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. He is the author of the Standard College Graduate School textbook on intelligence, from secrets to policy, now in its 7th edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Lowenthal.
Thank you, Ian.
And Mark, what did you make of the House intelligence hearings yesterday, where former Director John Brennan testified? Some of the questioners, and particularly Trey Gowdy, famous for the Benghazi hearing, was pretty hostile. But the main point that he made, which I thought was sort of somewhat tragic in a way, was Brennan said that on August the 4th, as evidence of this Russian interference in the elections mounted, Brennan called Alexander Bortnikov, the director of Russia's Federal Security Service, the FSB, and said, quote, "I said American voters would be outraged by any Russian attempt to interfere in the election." Well, it just didn't happen that way. And I'm astounded that why it is that you have an attack by a hostile foreign power on the very nature of American democracy itself. It's an electronic version of the Watergate, where instead of a bunch of bumbling burglars, this is a sophisticated electronic break-in, and we know what happened. But why do you think there isn't the outrage, and it's sort of fallen along partisan lines, where Democrats are mad and Republicans are making excuses for Putin?
Well, I think part of this reflects who won the election and who lost. And the Republicans are just seeing this through a filter that this is sour grapes, you guys lost, and you want to blame it on the fact that the Russians intervened. And they can't really step away from that and ask themselves, did something fundamental happen? And so they've, in effect, raised a very high bar of proof that it happened. And it's largely partisan, and I think that's why it's such a good thing that we now have Bob Mueller doing a separate investigation, but he's not partisan.
But what will it take to restore this sense that should be there, that, you know, we're all in together, and it's not a good thing for foreign adversaries to meddle in our elections? They're dysfunctional enough as to begin with.
God knows. I think it's going to take a fairly high standard of proof. But you know, you said in the introduction, this is like Watergate. Look what it took until a sufficient number of Republicans defected from Richard Nixon. I mean, there was this sort of slow drip over time, and then you get the smoking gun tape of the conversation between Haldeman and Nixon about using Richard Helms. And so a lot of it's going to ride on how good is the intelligence. And I have to say, as an intelligence officer, this is not a new problem. If a policymaker wants to reject your intelligence as insufficient or unproven, there is nothing to prevent that from doing it. And as to why they do it, it depends on the policymaker. But I think, unfortunately, at this point, we're seeing this through a very partisan lens, and that's unfortunate.
But how do the partisans feel about some of the basic stuff in intelligence, the being stewards of secrets, for example? I mean, we don't know. We know that the White House was warned about General Flynn, and yet they did nothing, and he kept having access to the country's most valuable secrets, and that also preceded his short tenure in the White House. During the transition, he was getting all this stuff, and we also learned about Donald Trump sharing secrets with the Russians in the Oval Office, perhaps unwittingly, but nevertheless. And then, of course, the other day in Israel, he made a big deal that I didn't give Israel away, you know.
Right.
We don't know.
Well, I mean, part of the problem we have here is that it's fairly evident now that the Trump campaign did not expect to win the election. And so they really were totally unprepared for assumption of power. And it was a very ragged transition. There wasn't a lot of proper vetting going on. You know, the campaign itself was very tumultuous. They went through three different campaign managers, two of whom have now been associated with attempts by the Russians to influence the outcome. And I don't think they were very sophisticated. I thought John Brennan yesterday really laid out how the Russians work. And it's not a question of them being communists. It's a question of being Russians. The Russians are very good intelligence operatives. And they will reel somebody in. They're not asking them to spy. They're not asking them to steal. They're asking them to be tools, but in such a way that they're appealing to something that's important to that person, and they may not even realize they're being used as tools. And that may be part of it also, that some of these people didn't realize what the Russians were doing to them, and now they're going to deny it because that wasn't in their heads at the time. And I thought John's testimony was very, very good. It was very forthright. But it was subtle. You have to really pay attention to it. And Gowdy was, he approaches this as a prosecutor. What's your evidence? This is not a criminal case. This is an intelligence case. And often in intelligence, it's not so much evidence, but you have patterns of behavior that lead you to conclusions. And that's what John was talking about yesterday.
But do you think that the difference between intelligence and law enforcement is understood? Because that was the point that Brennan was trying to make. You know, I was making an intelligence assessment, and there was certainly enough there to hand it off to the law enforcement people at the FBI to look into. And of course,
no, I don't think the members of the committee really understood it. I thought John made a very good attempt at explaining it. I try to explain it when I'm doing public speaking, when I'm teaching, and there's this assumption that you get this intelligence hit that just says, where Putin says to Lavrov, we're going to interfere in the election, we got him. You don't get that. It's a pattern. He saw a pattern of behavior and a pattern of relationships that concerned him and concerned General Clapper and concerned General Rogers, and that led them to release the assessment they released in January, which said it happened. Now, there's something interesting here. Dan Coats, who is the Director of National Intelligence, appointed by President Trump, gave his threat assessment testimony 2 weeks ago, and he said the same thing. He said the Russians are a threat, and the Russians intervened in our election. So this wasn't a Democratic appointee saying this. This was the DNI appointed by Donald Trump. It's in the first paragraph in his threat assessment under cyber. So this is, from the intelligence point of view, this is not a partisan activity. And I was really taken aback or surprised, pleasantly surprised, when I read Director Coates' testimony. Not that I have any doubts about Director Coates and his ability to do the job professionally, but it was such a strong statement.
So what do you think's happening on the Russian side? You've got a former...
The Russians are sitting there. They've already won.
Right.
The Russians have gotten everything they wanted.
Right.
Because they have thrown the election into disrepute. And that was part of what was bothering Putin, besides the fact that he had a preferred outcome. And having a preferred outcome in elections is not a big deal. The United States had a preferred outcome in the French election. We would have preferred Macron to Le Pen, or at least most of us would have.
Mm-hmm.
We had a preferred outcome in the Brexit vote. We didn't get what we wanted. So that's not an issue. But Putin was annoyed, bothered, that we questioned their election process in Russia because it's so one-sided. And he wanted to show, yours aren't any better than mine. Look how chaotic your election was. Look at all that's happening. So he's already scored a victory by creating more chaos.
Well,
and that's part of his goal, is just to sow disruption in the West.
Right, but it was Jeb Bush who referred to Donald Trump as the chaos candidate who would be the chaos president. And there's no question that...
Well, but clearly... as I said, that was the preference that the Russians had. They preferred Trump to Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton really annoyed them. during her tenure as Secretary of State, and they didn't want to deal with her anymore. That's fine. That's a choice. And so they had a preferred outcome. But in terms of discrediting our electoral process, we are the leading democracy in the world. And to discredit our election is a huge propaganda win. And the fact that it's going on, that the issue continues to have legs and creates more chaos, gives Putin another advantage, which he's distracting us from more important issues.
But in the broader sense, is this the new landscape of a new Cold War? In other words, it's not about bean counting nuclear weapons on both sides, although they still exist on both sides. This is more that this hybrid warfare that he's developed. I mean, I would think that just on the surface, it's an unusual phenomenon, one that we've never had before, where you have the combination of organized crime and national security, nuclear weapons, and the mafia. And on the other hand, you've also got this very cynical guy who seems to be obsessed from his KGB days with Glavny Protivnik, the idea of the main enemy. And that seems to be his focus. And I'm not sure he's doing much good for the Russian people, but he seems to be awfully good. No. He's awfully good at screwing the Americans up.
Well, my take on Putin is, and I spent a long time analyzing the Soviet Union, as most of us did in my generation, he has a losing hand. He probably knows he has a losing hand, and he's playing it very, very well. But everything with Putin is tremendously short-sighted. The first issue is, what's he selling? You know, the Soviet Union had something to sell. It was an absurd idea, communism, but it had attraction to other people. What's Putin selling? Russia? No one's going to buy that. And the trouble with Putin is, he's created a one-man rule. What happens after him? How does he step down from power? How does he hand off to a successor? It's a very short-sighted kind of system that depends on his continuation of power, which has to end at some point, one way or another. So it's not a very... So he's trying to... I mean, he's accumulating a fair amount of advantage right now, but it has no longevity. It has absolutely no longevity whatsoever. And it has no appeal beyond confronting the United States. Everything he does by comparing himself to us. And one of the things that drives him crazy is we no longer compare ourselves to him. We did during the Cold War. The Cold War is long past. They lost. And we don't use them as our yardstick anymore. And that really frustrates him. He wants to return to an age of superpower parity, and even this will not get him there.
But that's how Barack Obama treated him, I think, and how that's why he was had so much animus towards Obama. But that's not necessarily at least the intentions of Trump. I mean, the Oval Office photograph was said a lot. You know, he's confiding with them about firing the FBI guy and calling him a nut job. He's got Tillerson out there who's already made this big Arctic oil deal. My sense is that, you know, the only thing that could ever restore Putin, or at least, you know, the Siloviki are stealing the place blind, but in order to throw a few bones to the beleaguered people who unfortunately believe in Putin, you know, they could rise, if as long as they can get the price of oil back up again, they'd be in great shape.
Which is not going to happen.
Uh-huh.
I mean, oil. Putin needs oil to be at $100 a barrel for his budget to close. Or I haven't looked at this morning's prices, but we're in the range between 50 and 60. We're not going to see $100 a barrel oil again. If for no other reason, the Saudis won't let it happen, because they don't want Iran to make money. So if everything's depending on oil, again, he loses. He can't sustain this. And he doesn't make anything. He doesn't make anything that people want. I mean, Russia, in that sense, is a third world economy. They export natural resources, gold, oil, timber, some diamonds, and some weapons. But they don't make anything that people want to buy. So again, it's a very short-sighted outlook for him. Now, having said that, it doesn't mean that I would just allow what they did with the election to pass by. I would have the investigation. As I said, I'm very glad that former FBI Director Mueller is running it. Let the investigation play out, and then decide what you want to do after that.
But since this has been Donald Trump's biggest calling card, that he's, you know, I'm going to have good relations with Russia, and it seems as though that is not the great priority. That's what you're telling us. So what would be
what
would the great priority be? I mean, he's already handed China an enormous gift by tearing up the TPP. Should China be the U.S.'s priority in terms of foreign policy?
No, I don't think we have to choose. I mean, China has much greater capability, although I was just telling a class I was teaching today, I'm shorting China. China by mid-century hits a tremendous crisis, and that's very serious, because that's when Taiwan becomes an issue. Because in authoritarian states, when you have an internal crisis, what you do is externalize it, sort of like the Argentine junta and the Falklands. Now, I don't worry about China rising. I worry about the near inevitability of China stumbles. Now, it may not happen until mid-century, but that's going to happen. No, you don't choose sides. You follow your interests. You make a determination about what are my interests and follow them. Palmerston, the great British foreign secretary and prime minister, said, nations do not have permanent friends and they do not have permanent enemies. They have permanent interests. So I think that's the guideline now. Whether or not Mr. Trump can figure out what those are and achieve a consensus to allow him to go after them, that's another story, because this isn't his long suit by any means. He's not a strategist. He doesn't have a lot of strategists working for him. He has Mattis. Tillerson is not a strategist. McMaster's is a strategist. So he's a little bit thin on the ground in terms of intellectual firepower, in terms of the administration. But that's the goal. The goal isn't choosing which one you like better. It's what are your interests and how do you pursue them?
But just in the last minute or so then, Mark Lowenthal, with this constant permanent crisis and the daily drip of headlines about the Russians and already enormous amounts of information out there already about lots of questions about who funded Trump and the extent to which what's already in front of us might even be criminal, not to mention impeachable, it does seem that we're heading into a kind of shaky political era. What do you think is going to happen in terms of our strength and stability, let alone our foreign policy?
I agree. We're in a very shaky period, and we have an administration that still hasn't fully formed. I mean, the number of senior jobs that are unfilled is rather fascinating. Basically, all of the second and third tier jobs at defense and state have not been filled yet. And so there's sort of a power vacuum there, if you will. I'm not sure where this goes. The trouble with crisis, with issues like the Russia issue, is it becomes very, very distracting, and it sucks up so much time and attention, just as we saw happen in Watergate. Now, this isn't Watergate yet. I don't think we're at that pitch, but certainly in terms of an issue that's beginning to preoccupy the Trump administration, it's already achieved that. It is preoccupying them. And so this becomes very distracting. It becomes very hard for people at various levels in the government to focus attention on the types of things we were just talking about, which they keep coming back to what's happening in the investigation. And people start turning on each other. And we've begun to see that in the White House staff. People have begun to turn on each other. This is an amazingly leaky White House. You know, I know Donald Trump wants the FBI to investigate the leaks. I would start at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in the adjoining West Wing, because they are leaking on each other to save themselves.
But the reason, just in closing, the reason that these jobs are unfilled is because a lot of people didn't want to work for Trump and still don't want
That's
to work
right.
for And he also won't have anybody in there that said a nasty word about him ever. So that's the impasse. So the real question, just in closing, is do we try and help this guy succeed, even though he seems to be a train wreck, or do we put our efforts into getting rid of him as soon as possible?
That's a really tough call, and I have had several friends who thought about or asked about working in the administration, and you find yourself torn between, do I really want to work for this administration, or am I doing good for the country? And I will tell you, at the end of the day, you have to be able to work for the administration. If you can't work for them, you're not going to do any good for the country anyway. You have to be able to be compatible with the administration. This is you can tell yourself everything you want to tell yourself about, well, I'm just working for the country. You have to be able to work for the administration. And clearly they have had a problem with all these Republican seniors who said, we won't work for you. And then with their own filter of saying, if you weren't on board with us, we don't want you. It's very different. Ronald Reagan not only appointed one of his rivals as vice president, but appointed his rival's campaign manager, Jim Baker, as his White House chief of staff. And that was a marvelous, marvelous first White House, because he was able to reconcile all the factions. Donald Trump works in a different way than Ronald Reagan.
Well, Mark Lowenthal, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Lowenthal. He's the president of the Intelligence and Security Academy and a professor at the Johns Hopkins University. He has served as assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, vice chairman for evaluation at the National Intelligence Council, deputy assistant secretary of state for intelligence, and staff director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Dr. Lowenthal is the author of the Standard College Graduate School Textbook on Intelligence, From Secrets to Policy, now in its 7th edition. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into President Trump's visit with Pope Francis at the Vatican. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Tiziana Deering, who is a professor of social work at Boston College and the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston, an anti-poverty activist and advocate for social justice. She is the co-editor of Managing for Social Impact, Innovations in Responsible Enterprise. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tiziana Deering.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Tiziana. What do you make of the somewhat awkward meeting that took place in the Vatican between Donald Trump and Pope Francis? And, of course, Donald Trump, his wife and daughter were also in attendance. The pictures were of a pretty solemn-looking Pope, but I take it that things improved in the course of, this half-hour meeting?
You know, it does seem that it did. And one of the things that I found myself thinking, looking at the now already iconic picture of a sour-looking Pope Francis next to the Trump family, is these are both men who are acutely aware of their social media presence. Pope Francis is our first tweeting pope. He made some decisions very early in his papacy to have pictures taken of some stunning visual images, including washing the feet of the marginalized and poor. These are both people who are aware that they're being photographed and know how those photographs are used. So one can't be sure that the pope's dour look was on purpose, but one certainly shouldn't think that he's not aware of what he looks like when these pictures are happening.
Well, it was almost, Donald Trump was almost like a schoolboy. On the way out, he promised to read everything that the Pope had handed him, including, of course, the encyclical on the danger to the planet from global warming, which Donald Trump is doing everything in his power to thwart even the moderate and somewhat timid efforts so far to deal with this global impending crisis.
Yes. Yeah, well, and you know, one of the things that strikes me about this and that encyclical, which is called Laudato Si, or Our Common Home, is really quite a radical treatise on not only the environment, but the roles of technology and the free market economy in destroying the environment, especially for the poor and the marginalized. But one of the things that strikes me is we have seen a pattern with both now President and then just Donald Trump of really being quite starstruck when he meets famous and important people and they acknowledge him and he spends time with them. We've seen that everything from, you know, his early tweets and excitement about Robert Kraft and Tom Brady of the New England Patriots, the famous football team, to any of a number of other important figures. And it did seem like the president was kind of starstruck in being in the presence of Pope Francis.
So what do you think of the chances, though, of any kind of lasting impact? Because as much as he is starstruck, he's also ephemeral and fickle. And he's capable of saying one thing on one day and the next day saying the exact opposite with equal conviction. So do you think there is a way that the Pope can make an impact on particularly on his Trump's assault on the environment? Or do you think that he's so preoccupied with the Russian situation that he's actually, in effect, sort of outsourced everything to the House and Senate, and they're the ones that are really doing the evil deeds?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. One of the things that we've seen with this president is that he seems to be profoundly influenced by the last person he was with. So right now he's influenced by whatever the Pope's exhortations around immigration and the environment and peacemaking that he made behind closed doors. But President Trump will come back to the United States, and we've already seen such a remarkable difference between foreign policy overseas President Trump and domestic policy in the White House, President Trump, that I'm not sure he gives us any good reason to believe that there's a lot of sticking power to the Pope's messages once he is back in the White House under siege and dealing on domestic policy again. And there's no reason to believe that President Trump doesn't see climate change in his lens as a domestic policy issue, not a global issue the way the Pope himself has expressed that he sees it.
But at the end of their meeting, apparently, the Pope, in a very avuncular way, took the president's wife, Melania, aside and basically said, "What are you feeding him?" In other words, he could do with a little slimming of the waistline, mm-hmm. you know, cut back on the Big Macs and the sponge cake. What did you make of that?
Well, you know, one of the things that the Pope is a priest. And one of the first things that priests are trained to be is pastoral, ministers to families. And what I really saw, and maybe this is the Catholic in me, but what I really saw in that moment was the Pope shifting from his role as a head of state to being a pastoral human being, engaging the family, making them feel welcome, finding common ground there. In addition, I think he was just plain quite charmed by the First Lady, who, by any count, is an absolutely beautiful woman, and whose culture he has some familiarity with.
Explain further. I mean, she's Slovenian, right?
She's Slovenian, and apparently he knows the Slovenian dessert, and he has, in my understanding, always been very careful to learn a little bit more about the culture and background of the people that he's going to be meeting with. I would not be at all surprised if he had gone out of his way to understand her background a little bit. But again, I think my main point here is, and this comes back, Ian, to your question as well about what are the chances that anything that the Pope said to the president will stick. It is my guess that the president has rarely come into encounter with a powerful leader who is also a deep and profound pastor. And so no one can look into his heart and know if sort of a moment of conversion, and I don't mean Roman Catholic conversion, I just sort of mean spiritual awakening, is there or is going to happen. But I'd be willing to bet that he has not often come across a man of power who is so deeply a pastoral person who can engage with you at a very human and soul-based level. And my guess is that that really was quite striking for the president and something unlike what he's experienced before.
But the only person in that meeting, of course, that's had a conversion, a religious conversion, is the daughter Ivanka, who converted to Judaism when she married Jared Kushner. She's also supposedly a big advocate of doing something about climate change. She apparently used to date Leonardo DiCaprio, who she got into the Trump Tower during the transition period. And so, by the way, it did Al Gore. Mm-hmm. One wonders what kind of impact they had. Now, of course, we have to add to that list of lobbyists for the planet, this lifeboat Earth that we're all in, that the Trump administration is drilling holes through this lifeboat Earth, and we could all sink under. I mean, the latest stuff from the Antarctic is so shocking. Huge chunks of ice are going to be breaking off, and sea level may rise much, much quicker than people have even projected. So any thoughts there in terms of Ivanka's role and some teaming up with the Pope?
Well, you know, so it is an interesting question, because one of the few people that we do know does have consistent and profound influence on President Trump is his daughter. That she has, in fact, been both a moderating influence and has been able, at least at some point. Now, there are reports out there, there have been other times when she has failed to sway him away from a particular choice or behavior. But she has kept his attention on issues that are important to her as much as anyone can. If she had any kind of a profound moment there at the Vatican, if she was influenced even further by, for example, the Pope's writings on climate change, she could, in fact, be a more effective ally pretty much than anybody else who was on the team or in the room, because we do know she's somebody he really does listen to and trust. And, you know, as you point out, once again, the president may be treating climate change as a domestic policy issue, but it is a profound species-level issue, and one that has implications not only for livability of the planet, but also for the disproportionate impact that climate change will have on the people the Pope cares about most, who are the marginalized, the vulnerable, those who are already hurting in the streets. And everything we know about climate change is that it disproportionately impacts those vulnerable populations.
So the exchange of gifts, of course, involved the Pope giving President Trump an olive tree statue, and he said he hopes that this olive tree, you may be this olive tree to make peace. Trump responded, "We can use peace." What's your sense of, it seems that, again, going back to him being led by the nose by whoever he last spoke to, it does seem that this idea of the ultimate Gordian knot, Middle East peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, is predicated upon actually going to war almost with Iran. So I'm very confused about what exactly the achievement is here. But as you know, the Pope has been a leading advocate, and he's intervened personally in lots of efforts to make peace and to end, for example, the 60-plus year long deep freeze between the United States and Cuba. He had a very active role in brokering that deal. So any sense of whether there was any discussions about the Middle East peace?
It would be surprising to me if there were not. If one followed closely the president's trip to Saudi Arabia, the conversations he had in public there, and then his engagements in Israel, both the conversations that he had where he, you know, visibly tied relationship with Iran and Saudi Arabia's concerns and interests there with the peace process, as well as his sort of regular encouragement that it's time for Middle East peace to happen, he is clearly not only professing an interest in being a part of the solution there, but has consistently suggested, as the world's sort of greatest deal maker in his mind, he may be uniquely positioned to help broker something. So given that posture and given his public statements, given the fact that those were the countries he chose to visit first, it's impossible for me to imagine, well, that's overstatement, but it's hard for me to imagine, also given that we know the Pope chose to emphasize peacemaking even in his gifts, how did that not come up? How would that not been a part of what they discussed? And it's tempting, at least, to assume that when the president said to the Pope afterward, "I won't forget what you said," that the peace message seems to have resonated for him in particular.
So what's your sense, though, of where Catholics are in this country? By and large, they voted for the Democrats, but conservative Catholics certainly supported Trump. Obviously, there have been some extremely conservative bishops in this country and cardinals who have been somewhat marginalized by the Pope, or in the case of Archbishop Cardinal Dolan, he said he's getting a tune-up, changing his outlook. And, of course, he sat between, as you probably recall, at the Al Smith dinner between Trump and Hillary Clinton, where Trump actually made something of a fool of himself. But my sense is that this stark guns and butter issue that Trump has brought to the fore, where he's basically eviscerating all programs for the poor in order to give tax cuts to the rich, and transferring money from the environment and from diplomacy into more money for the Pentagon, to the extent that the additional amount of money for the Pentagon is the equivalent of the entire annual budget of the Russians for their military. So it's just somewhat obscene in terms of the old guns and butter paradigm. You know, you're just pouring money at more and more guns that you don't need and starving those in need of butter.
Yeah, the president's budget is a breathtaking abandonment of the most vulnerable and marginalized, as well as of any portion of the social contract that is social care between the state and its citizens. We understand from a negotiating standpoint the claims that this is an anchoring budget, meaning you pull them far out so that the realm of negotiations has moved further in your direction. I understand all of that, but it is an abandonment of that whole component of our social contract and a squashing of the needs of our most vulnerable. And it's really hard to interpret that budget document any other way. You know, there are 70 million Catholics, roughly, in the United States, and they are not a monolithic voting bloc. There are conservative Catholics who believe that the right to life is the fundamental Catholic voting issue, who are encouraged by this president and his view on abortion and choice. There are also liberal Catholics who feel very strongly that this president doesn't represent the Catholic social justice teaching principles that this pope is particularly known for standing for. The Catholic Democrats, for example, put out an open letter to the president over the weekend, you know, sort of exhorting him to listen to the pope's calls on not only climate change, but immigrants and health care and poverty, et cetera. So, you know, the Catholic vote is not monolithic on this, but it represents the spectrum of all the different ways that the church teaches Catholics to care about the life of the human being, which is important and full of dignity, full of God-given dignity. So the president is certainly not in alignment with the full range of what the pope represents on that, or what the sort of diaspora of Catholics in the United States represent.
Well, but that's to the credit of Catholics, is they've at least had consistency on the life issues, because they equally oppose abortion and capital punishment, which is not the case for evangelicals.
That's right. And in my opinion, the really visionary Catholics then bring in questions of poverty, immigration, health care, social justice across social welfare as another aspect of human dignity and the importance of the human person. And, you know, we see a lot of conversation about that out in Catholic communities now. And this pope has been particularly strong in recalling that social justice call of the church that really came forward in 150 years of teaching around social welfare and work and the social contract, et cetera, that had fallen, you know, arguably to some extent by the wayside in the Catholic dialogue in the United States.
Well, Tiziana Dehring, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation.
And again, I've been speaking with Tiziana Dehring, who's a professor of social work at Boston College and the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston, an anti-poverty activist and advocate for social justice. She's the co-editor of Managing for Social Impact, Innovations in Responsible Enterprise. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.